Alabama abortion. Democrats try to get their story straight on why they spied on the Trump campaign, and the Democrats' clown car of presidential candidates on this edition of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing. For a change.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
This is The Uprising, and Scott is away, but the mice will play. Tim Donner, sitting in for Scott Cosenza this week. I'm also known as, in Scott's words, the immediate past co-host of The Uprising, but given the onerous and gigantic responsibility of becoming the Joe Biden for President correspondent for The Uprising, I had to relinquish my duties as a co-host, along with almost all other duties in my life, because of the enormity of the task of putting Joe Biden in perspective every single week. But in any case, I've been liberated from the bondage of slave driver Scott Cosenza and his assignment to me to become a Joe Biden correspondent. But as Joe Biden might say, Scott Cosenza, I'm sure, will be putting me back in chains next week. Now, in the meantime, a lot of ground to cover this week. I mentioned it all in the opening. We'll talk about the Alabama abortion law, easily the most restrictive ever passed since Roe versus Wade in 1973. That was 46 years ago. We'll also talk about how Democrats are starting to point fingers at each other, most specifically in the Obama Justice Department and the FBI and the CIA. They're starting to say, it was him, not me. I didn't do it. Here was the intent. They're trying to get the story straight and starting to turn on each other. We'll have a little bit about that, particularly the feud, the growing feud between Rod Rosenstein and James Comey, which is quite the cat fight, I'll tell you. It's quite the swamp fight going on between those two in particular. And we will get to a field of Democratic candidates that now numbers two dozen, count them, 24 declared Democratic presidential candidates trying to unseat President Trump. I mean, you can't tell those players without a scorecard, but I think the way it is, there's two people at the top of the scorecard and the rest have been like sent to the minor leagues in some form since baseball season is underway. We might as well use that analogy, shouldn't we? So it's Biden and Bernie and then the other 22, all of whom are in single digits at this point. And Biden has doubled Bernie's numbers in the polls. So his lead just keeps growing. And I'm sorry, you just got to say, it says a whole lot more about the other 23 candidates than it does about Biden, that he's leading. I mean, he's lapping the field right now. He's so far ahead, the rest of the candidates are barely in sight. The only one he can see sort of coming up 20 lengths behind or 10 is Bernie Sanders. The rest are in the distant rearview mirror. But let's start with Alabama and the abortion law passed there, which, by the way, was then replicated, not nearly as severe in Missouri a few days later, but nevertheless quite severe when you look at the totality of law that's been passed regarding abortion since Roe versus Wade in 1973. So let's start out by playing for you a Republican senator who spoke from Alabama, an Alabama state senator, who described why this law was passed. And it's actually quite remarkable. He admits that it's for a purpose other than just restricting abortion in Alabama. And then it's followed up by a highly emotional reaction from a Democratic state senator in Alabama.
What this bill is designed to do is to go to the Supreme Court and challenge that particular precedence that said in 1973 that abortion is legal on demand, essentially anytime, anywhere, for any reason.
You just said to my daughter, you don't matter. You don't matter in the state of Alabama. That the state of Alabama don't care nothing about you, baby. I got to go home and tell her, the state of Alabama don't care nothing about you, baby.
Now, you know, that lament pretty much sums up the nature of the problem when it comes to abortion. The two sides are so deeply polarized that discussion is barely possible. The abortion issue has been, is now, always will be so explosively emotional, as expressed by that Democratic state senator, that reason really has no chance to prevail in the debate. Reasonable people on both sides seem to hardly exist. There are Republicans, many sort of nominally pro-life Republicans, who will oppose abortion for political reasons, but they won't really fight for it. And there are some of the Democratic Party who may be secretly pro-life, but have to take a pro-choice stand publicly, who are not that emotionally attached to it in one way or another. But outside of that group, the two sides are so explosively polarized on the issue that you just wonder whether any kind of meeting of the minds can possibly occur. But let's look at the end game. I mean, the end game is getting this up to the Supreme Court, which means it has to be challenged. It already has been by the ACLU and by this time, probably two or three other groups. They will challenge the law in court. It'll go most likely from the district court level to the circuit court, to the appellate court, and then to the Supreme Court, where the whole point is to force a decision on whether this court, which is divided 5-4 in favor of constitutionalist jurists as opposed to progressive ones, and the sides are deeply divided, more so now than when Anthony Kennedy was on the court, with his replacement by Neil Gorsuch. That takes the court to the right, but not way far to the right, because you now have John Roberts replacing Anthony Kennedy as the swing vote. And anybody who saw or read about or witnessed how John Roberts, the Chief Justice, ruled on Obamacare can hardly have much confidence that even though he is decidedly pro-life, that he would be willing to overturn longstanding Supreme Court precedent, because he doesn't like to do that. He may be conservative ideologically, but he's also conservative in terms of his character. He's conservative in his personality. He's conservative in the way that he moves the court slowly and incrementally, probably because he thinks his job as Chief Justice is to not get too involved in the political realm. But the point is, once it gets to the Supreme Court, on the assumption that it does, which seems very likely, most of the people I respect, including Scott, believe that they're not going to overturn Roe versus Wade. Now, maybe they will if and when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg actually does pass. She's 85 and she's been hit by cancer 3 times. If and when she dies and is replaced by yet another constitutionalist justice named by Trump, assuming that it happens while he's still president in the next 2 or 6 years, Then you're talking about a 6-3 constitutional majority. Then it would seem certain that Roe versus Wade would be overturned, or it would be probably very likely. But with this slim 5-4 majority and the hesitancy of this court to make, shall we say, revolutionary type decisions, I think it makes sense to say that it's less than a 50-50 shot that this Supreme Court would overturn Roe versus Wade. But who knows? We don't really know for sure, but we will find out soon enough, won't we? Now, the Democrats are having enough trouble trying to figure out which of their now 24 candidates would stand the best chance of defeating President Trump. Now, of course, the conventional wisdom is that it would be Joe Biden. He's way ahead. I mean, he's way ahead among the professional Democrats and apparently among rank-and-file Democrats, all of whom, let's be clear, there's a lot of progressive talk going on, and we'll talk more about it. But let's be clear that most Democrats are interested in one thing, a candidate who can beat Donald Trump even if he doesn't pass every ideological litmus test. If they didn't feel that way, I mean, there'd be something wrong with them, honestly. I mean, you got to pick someone who can win. If they can't win, what's the point? I mean, in 1972, and I've drawn this analogy many times, the analogy, and I just did a five facts video for LibertyNation.com to this effect, that the 1960s and 2010s are really similar in the sense that the response from the left to the radicalization of America, the increasing radicalization of the Democrat Party and of the left in response to Donald Trump, is very similar to when the Democrats came off a loss to Richard Nixon in 1968 that was devastating to them. They detested Richard Nixon with every fiber of their being, and their response was to turn to the most liberal presidential nominee in American history, George McGovern, in 1972. The result, Nixon won 49 states, McGovern won one state. Are they going the same way now? I mean, in response to the catastrophe that was the election of Donald Trump, from the standpoint of the left, have they now said that we hate him so much that we must come up with a candidate who is more opposite to him than anybody else? If that was so, they'd pick someone like Cory Booker or maybe Kamala Harris or certainly Elizabeth Warren. And if they nominate someone like that, I would personally predict another at least 40 state win, maybe a 400 electoral vote, 350 at an absolute minimum victory for Donald Trump, which would be bigger, of course, than 2016 when Trump won 306 electoral votes, won the Electoral College by 14% over Hillary Clinton. So that's what's facing the Democrats now as they prepare to do battle amongst themselves first. I mean, how they even do it among 24. You know, we're only like 5 weeks away from the first Democratic debate, even though it's June of the year before the election when it starts. But, you know, as Yogi Berra once said, it gets late early around here. Around here being in Washington, D.C., as I sit in the just outside the confines of the swamp, actually what they call just outside the beltway. So, you know, the world divides for people inside the beltway, inside the swamp. The world divides between inside the beltway and outside. And that gives you a good idea of the insular nature of the Washington bubble that is surrounded by a circular beltway. And then there's the rest, the outside world. You remember that poster, the New Yorker's view of the world, where they had, you know, the Manhattan skyline large, and then they had like a brown spot for New Jersey, and then you go west and there's a couple of cactus over mountain states and Arizona, stuff like that. And then, of course, a little blip for Chicago and a little bit on the West Coast. But the point is that the New York part of the image was about 85% of everything that happened. And the rest of the country was maybe 15%. I guess you had to be there or see it. But those of you who saw it, you know what I'm talking about. And the Washingtonians' view of the world, the swamp's view of the world, is even more confined than that. It's confined to the what? 15, 20, 30, whatever it is, square miles in and around Washington, D.C. And in that swamp, Democrats are girding their loins for the oncoming wave of revelations about the Obama Justice Department and FBI and CIA laying the groundwork for surveillance, for spying on the Trump campaign. And ultimately, of course, setting the stage for the Mueller investigation, which took 22 months to complete. And now, of course, the Democrats would like to start as many as 20 more investigations of Trump, who's basically saying now, you know, pound sand. You had 2 years. You threw out every accusation, including that I was a Russian asset. And now that you couldn't prove it, with an investigation run by a man who hired a remarkable number of not just Democrats, but partisan, politically involved contributors to Obama and Clinton for his investigative team. They still couldn't come up with anything to get him on collusion, but now they want to restart everything and look into every dark corner of Trump's life. And basically, the president and his people are saying, no. You don't get a do-over. You don't get to do it again. You don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And so the tables are turning. Now, before we get into how they're responding, the Democrats, to the tables being turned on them so that Attorney General William Barr, who is brutally competent, I mean, they may be scared of him. They may be trying to demonize him. They're doing all of that. They're calling him a Trump lackey. They're calling him dishonest. Some are saying he should go to jail. You know, forget all that. That's a whole bunch of hot air. What they really do is that they fear William Barr because he's so good at what he does. And he's now hired a second who's serving as a virtual special prosecutor to go after the truth in how this whole investigation started. So they're scared of Barr. They're scared of Michael Horowitz, the inspector general, who'll come out with the first report on all this. They're scared of their own shadows, I think, at this point, because the tables have turned so completely from all the focus on Trump as a Russian spy to them and what sort of backhanded, illegal, unethical, unconstitutional actions they may have taken in kicking off this investigation to begin with, the kicking off spying of the Trump campaign, which, of course, ultimately led to the Mueller investigation. So what are the top Obama administration officials like John Brennan and James Clapper and James Comey? What are they doing about this? How are they preparing? Well, James Comey, for one, is lawyering up. And he's, you know, of course, he got a willing audience at a CNN town hall. Why he's worthy of a town hall as a disgraced and dismissed former FBI director who seems to have angered people from every side of the aisle over the last couple of years. He's going on CNN and a town hall and talking about John Brennan, that really Brennan was the one who sort of was the point man for the decisions to get the FISA warrant and get this Trump dossier, which is a disinformation dossier, which, as we all know, was commissioned by the Hillary Clinton campaign. But that's just a detail. Evidently, that was not included in the application for the FISA warrant. Here's a dossier. And by the way, it was formulated by Donald Trump's political enemies, but never mind that. But among the other people that Comey attacked was Rod Rosenstein, who he defended a year ago because he's the one who, you know, ultimately decided to hire special counsel Bob Mueller. He's the one who made the decision that there would be a special counsel investigation. So Comey defended him. But now, a year later, he's saying that Rosenstein didn't have the strength or the character to stand up to Trump. And Rod Rosenstein did not take altogether too kindly to that.
Now the former director seems to be acting as a partisan pundit, selling books and earning speaking fees while speculating about the strength of my character and the fate of my immortal soul. I kid you not. That is disappointing.
James Comey on the fate of Rod Rosenstein's immortal soul. This is what it's come to. This is the kind of positioning and posturing and finger-pointing and protecting of one's rear end that is going on now in advance of the impending revelations. And there's going to be a wave of them, you know, because we're going to get a report from the Inspector General Michael Horowitz first, most likely, because he's been working on it for some time now. And he doesn't, though, have the authority to recommend prosecution. He doesn't have the capacity or the authority to refer a criminal prosecution. He can only conduct an investigation and share his results. But then we've got Attorney General William Barr's report with his new lead investigator, who will likely deliver a report that's probably not entirely dissimilar to the Mueller report, only from the other end, on how the investigation actually started. So the Democrats are preparing their talking points on how they're going to respond to the inevitable revelations. And John Brennan's pretty clear about what he's going to say. So when the first blush of information comes out, here's likely what you're going to be hearing from John Brennan, and CIA director, who's really at the heart of this, and how he's going to explain it all away along with the other top Obama administration officials.
I think they're trying to imply and to really, you know, indicate that there was a misuse of authorities. That was not the case. Does CIA spy? Yes. Do we spy against our foreign adversaries? Yes. Do we spy against domestic individuals? No, we do not. We work very closely with the FBI. And when the Russians were trying to interfere in that election and to change the outcome of it in their favor, we, CIA and FBI, worked very collaboratively so that we could have that ability to see what the Russians were doing and who they were working with.
Okay, so that's their story, and they're sticking with it. The expletive will soon be hitting the fan on this. But let me just issue a minor warning here that we should not make the same mistake as the left. As the left did about the supposed Russian collusion. If we spike the ball now when we're at the 5-yard line instead of waiting for the end zone, only to find that there was less there than we thought. We may think we know a lot. There's a lot of facts out there about how the Trump campaign was set up, from George Papadopoulos all the way down to the way that the Trump campaign was spied on, to the way the FISA warrant was secured. We think we know, and we do know, a lot of facts about all of that. But leave it to the Attorney General and his charges to connect the dots for us before we start spiking the ball. Now, on that same note, I was somewhat disconcerted by the reaction on the right this week, most specifically among a bunch of congressional Republicans, even a couple of senators, to a statement by Rashida Tlaib, you know, spelled T-L-A-I-B, so I keep saying Tlaib, but others say Tlaib, how T-L-A-I-B can be pronounced like T-A-L-I-B, I don't know, but that's neither here nor there. So Rashida Tlaib, you know, well-known anti-Semite, freshman member of Congress from Minnesota, and one of only two Muslim members of Congress. Now, she's made several anti-Semitic remarks that were either blatantly anti-Semitic or hinted at anti-Semitism. And I think those have been well chronicled. Then she said this week, which sparked a great deal of outrage from Republicans.
Well, it's a kind of a calming feeling, I always tell folks, when I think of the Holocaust and the tragedy of the Holocaust, and the fact that it was my ancestors, Palestinians, who lost their land and some lost their lives, their livelihood, the human dignity, their existence in many ways have been wiped out on some people's passport. I mean, just all of it was in the name of trying to create a safe haven for Jews.
Okay, so outrage all over the internet. It went viral, as they say, or as they also say, Twitter. The Twitterverse blew up over that remark. And, you know, this is a sort of a mirror image of the way that the left responds almost like Pavlov's dogs to anything Donald Trump says. Think about what she said. She, again, has certainly made thinly veiled anti-Semitic statements since she was elected to the House last November, but this hardly seems like one. I mean, what she was saying was that her people gave up their land to establish Israel just a few years after the Holocaust had finally ended. And yes, it's true that the Palestinians hardly did so willingly. And yes, it's true that the motives that she ascribed in that soundbite are not exactly historically accurate. But to respond to it as if she had meant to say that she feels all warm and fuzzy when she thinks about the Holocaust is to take it completely out of context. You know, if you cry wolf too often, people stop listening, which is why most Americans aren't really paying attention to the repeated savaging of Donald Trump day after day by every Democrat and every mainstream media outlet, from the New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times, MSNBC, CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, you know, the players without a scorecard. They just don't pay any attention anymore because everything Donald Trump does is an outrage. He's a racist every day. He's a Nazi a couple of days of the week. He is evil and he is stupid and he's a buffoon, and yet he masterminded a plot to win the presidency illegitimately. I mean, they believe all these things at the same time. There's no coherence to it other than the fact that they were basically driven insane by the election of Donald Trump and have yet to recover. In fact, I don't know that they've really gone much beyond maybe the second stage of grief. I'm not sure. I think the first. I think they're still on the longest river in Egypt, denial. But let's get now, because, boy, we've waited too long. It's a guilty pleasure, honestly, to be able to talk about the Democrats' field of candidates. You know, it's now up to 24 candidates. Yes, folks, a full 24 candidates running for president under the Democratic banner. And it's really hard to believe that a lot of these candidates aren't, you know, running on some obscure third party that nobody ever heard of, or some independent trying to make some kind of a statement, because the positions they take are so radically out of the mainstream. So many of their positions, from the Green New Deal to reparations for the descendants of slaves, to Medicare for all, to giving 16-year-olds the vote, to, oh, let's see, what else? Oh, yeah, we're going to get rid of the Electoral College as well. And that's just, for starters, there's plenty of other buttes in there, too. But the field increasing to 24 this week. Let's start with the newest candidates of all. One of them is a longstanding Trump enemy, probably the most well-known, if not powerful, mayor by virtue of his position, the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, who's entered the race touting his anti-Trump bona fides. Now, let's play just a snippet of his announcement video, and then followed by a commentator on CNN, of all places, John Avlon, pointing out that in New York City itself, the people who are actually governed by Bill de Blasio widely view him as not just incompetent, but also lazy.
There's plenty of money in this world. There's plenty of money in this country. It's just in the wrong hands. I'm a New Yorker. I've known Trump's a bully for a long time. This is not news to me or anyone else here. And I know how to take him on. Donald Trump must be stopped. I've beaten him before, and I will do it again. I'm Bill de Blasio, and I'm running for president because it's time we put working people first.
One of the big problems with Bill de Blasio is he is not showing up to work. He comes in late. He doesn't come in at all. He seems utterly disinterested in the job of running America's largest big city. Again, this is somebody who has been underwater often in the polls in a city that's 6-1 Democrat.
Doesn't want to go to work in New York as mayor, but he would work for the people when he enters the White House. Now, all of that aside, I want to point back to the first thing that de Blasio said in that soundbite. There's plenty of money in this world. It's just in the wrong hands. Now, you want to talk about frightening. This guy, like so many other leftists, at least admits in this case that he would play God in determining who does and who does not deserve to have money. Think about it. Think about the nakedness of that statement. Now, to give you another snippet, for those of you, and I'm presuming that most of you, if not all of you, or many of you, something like that, don't really watch or listen to MSNBC. If you do, then what you hear coming up won't surprise you. But if you don't, I wanted to give you just a brief window, ever so brief, window into MSNBC. And this is all you need to hear about the kind of thing that the MSNBC audience is bombarded with day after day after day. This is longtime New York operator and Trump enemy Donnie Deutsch talking about on MSNBC about Trump taking action against illegal immigrants.
Think about that our country now, and the commander-in-chief authorized ICE military police to literally go to the streets in 10 cities across this country, including New York, where we are, and storm and show up and grab families and children. We're going to scary places, guys, that always happen in other parts of the world and are happening here. They are running just like the Jews ran from the Nazis.
Okay, see, they can't stop with the Trump is a Nazi, Trump is as Hitler thing. And I think what they don't realize is that when you keep saying that day after day, because he rounded up some illegal immigrants who aren't supposed to be in the country to begin with, who were breaking the law by being here, who are part of a growing crop of illegal immigrants that numbers anywhere from 11 to 22 million by a couple of estimates in the country. You do that, and now you're Adolf Hitler reincarnate. And this is what MSNBC is running out there, this stuff, every single day. Just saying, just giving you a little breath of what MSNBC is running out day after day after day. As I said, okay, now, the Democratic field, let's get to that before this thing ends. You know, I'm thinking now, maybe now that it's an even 24 candidates in the Democratic field for president, that we could call them the Dirty Dozens. But whether we do or not, it's every day more closely resembling a clown car, the Democratic field of truly, you know, unimpressive candidates. Two dozen of them. Two more this week, one of them, Bill de Blasio, as we said, who's the most high-profile mayor in America, probably, and then one of the most low-profile governors in the nation, Steve Bullock of Montana. And no, I had never heard of him before either. They both announced this week, and you want to get an idea of the vacuousness of so many in this Democratic field. I want to play for you this guy, Bullock, who now wants to become president and is actually running under a major party banner. Okay, he had a town hall this week, and a woman came forward to ask, like, the most basic question you could ask of a governor.
Yes, ma'am.
What have you been proudest to achieve as governor?
I am happy that hopefully my kids still know my most important job is being their dad. I think the things where, you know, as governor, it's not like attorney general when you know you won or lost a case. Sometimes you won't have impacts for years.
Yeah, that guy's running for president. I mean, he can't name one thing that, he's done as governor, except to say that his children still know that they come first in his life. And I may have done a couple of things, but, you know, it'll be 10, 20, maybe 30 years before you really realize the brilliance of these moves. The guy can't name one thing he's done as governor of Montana, and yet he wants to become, or has become now, the 23rd candidate to throw his name into the Democrats' increasingly large hat. All right, so what else? All right, we had a beautiful back and forth between the front runner, Joe Biden, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders on the issue of climate change. Let's go with AOC and Bernie first, because they unleashed very thinly veiled attacks on Joe Biden's dangerously insufficient commitment to radical action on climate change. And then Biden responded. Let's start with AOC and Bernie.
I will be damned if the same politicians who refused to act then are going to try to come back today and say we need a middle of the road approach to save our lives. That is too much for me.
When you're dealing with the future of the planet and making sure that our kids and our grandchildren have a healthy and habitable world in which to live, I don't know how you go too far. I mean, this is an existential threat, not just to the United States, but to the entire planet.
Okay, so Biden comes back and says, hey, when it comes to the climate, I'm every bit the extremist they are.
You've never heard me say middle of the road. I've never been the middle of the road on the environment.
And I tell her to just, the statement that I made and look at my record, she'll find that nobody has been more consistent about taking on the environment and a green revolution than I have.
Okay, says all the words after stumbling, of course, and taking about 10 seconds to say what should have taken two or three. But never mind that. The fact is, he's still lapping the field. Think about that. Joe Biden is laying waste to 23 other candidates in the Democrat field. I mean, look, we make a joke out of him and call him a buffoon and all this and have some fun with it. But, this guy looks like he may just run away and hide in getting the nomination. Joe Biden. I know. It's incredible to me, too. I mean, he's polling in the 30s. Bernie Sanders is in the teens. He's the only other candidate in double digits. All the rest of them, a booty judge, as we're required to call him on this show, and Pocahontas, and Cory Booker, he's completely off the radar, but all of them are down in single digits. Kamala Harris is nowhere. None of them are anywhere except Biden and then Bernie holding on and carrying the progressive mantle. So the amount of roadkill on the Democratic side grows with each passing week. Let me give you a name you might not even remember. Beto, don't call me. Beto, don't call me Robert Francis O'Rourke, the loser of the Texas Senate race last year. Remember, he was a thing for about a week. Beto mania, flailing his hands everywhere. And Jimmy Fallon did a great impression of him on Saturday Night Live. And it's really kind of sad to see how far he's fallen. I mean, he's at 3%, 4% in the polls, something like this. But he does have some ways of trying to restart the engine or get it out of first gear anyway. So he went on The View. And that's, of course, a mandatory rite of passage for Democratic presidential candidates. He went on The View and listened to his blathering response, his apology for his whiteness and maleness and privilege under the withering questioning of Meghan McCain on The View.
We did a Vanity Fair cover to announce your campaign, and you said you were, quote, born to be in it. And you said you, quote, sometimes help raise your kids. These are things in my mind that a female candidate wouldn't be able to get away with. Do you have any regrets about launching on the cover of Vanity Fair?
You're right. There are things that I have been privileged to do in my life that others cannot. And I think the more that I travel and listen to people and learn from them, the clearer that becomes to me. When you have 10 times the wealth in white America than you do in black America, the systematic foundational discrimination that we have in this country in every aspect of life is something that I have not experienced.
I mean, this guy is basically renouncing everything about himself, his life, his upbringing, his culture. I mean, he's willing to just throw it all away and say, yeah, I feel guilty and, I had all this white privilege. It's just, I don't think the voters respond well to that. How about something like, yeah, I have had white privilege. And I think the test is not whether I've had the white privilege, but what did I do with it? What did I do with the privileges that I was blessed with in being born in this country? I mean, he could have said, I ran for Congress and I served three terms, as he did, and I helped advance this issue or that issue, or I did things charitably or did things in my community, or, I helped old ladies across the street. I mean, I don't care what it is, but why not say, yeah, I have had privilege. I'm very, very blessed. But I think the question is, what did I do with the privilege? And then go from there. But instead, she's just cloying and pandering and apologizing. Oh, it's just painful to watch. I mean, it really is. And talk about painful. Oh, poor old Pocahontas. I mean, her candidacy, her numbers have dropped like a rock since she got into the race. I mean, she got in, she's like 15%, maybe something like that. She's now down at, what, 7, 8, something like that. In the polls, you can't even keep track of the numbers. But she thought, Senator Elizabeth Warren thought, that she could curry a lot of favor with the far left of her party and give herself a little sort of jump ahead in this 24-person presidential field by publicly refusing to accept an invitation to go on a town hall on the evil Fox News, figuring that the left would applaud her and say, good for you for not going on that, state-run pro-Trump media or whatever they call it. But, you know, poor old Pocahontas can't win for losing because the goddesses of The View, again, that rite of passage for all Democratic presidential candidates, actually criticized her for not going on Fox News.
I think that it's being very dismissive of so many Americans for her not to go on Fox News. Fox News was the top basic cable network in April. It finished in 2018 as the most watched basic cable network for the third consecutive year among both primetime and total day viewers. I think there are a lot of real journalists there, like Chris Wallace, like Shep Smith. And I think if you want to be the president of the United States for everyone, then you need to speak to everyone.
I kind of agree.
Yes. And you know what? If you can't face the Fox audience, you can't face the U.S. It's that simple.
You know, Whoopi does have a way. Whoopi Goldberg does have a way of sort of presenting something in an entertaining and nitty-gritty kind of way. I mean, she's a leftist. She's a hard leftist, but she's a good entertainer. And she's pretty good on that show, which, you know, unfortunately, I'm forced to watch because I have to pick out sound bites from it. So I never watch the whole thing. But, you know, since so many people do, I almost apologize for using stuff from that show, that, you know, daytime chat up show for people that are home and have nothing better to do, I guess. But other people watch it, so we have to cover it. And, we're going to close with one more from The View. And this is, again, Whoopi Goldberg kind of at her best. And she's talking about yet another obscure Democrat presidential candidate. But this is one who, well, put it this way. The average American looking at this field, they're like, they know Biden. They probably know Bernie Sanders. They might know a couple of the others, but they don't know people like John Hickenlooper, the governor of Colorado. I mean, they don't know anything about most of these candidates. I mean, I could go down the list of names. Jay Inslee, for example. Has anybody ever heard of him? But, you know, most of the time, the hosts of The View and people in the media will know them because it's their job to know them, but not in the case of yet another obscure, entirely unknown former congressman running for president under the Democratic banner. And The View, well, they said, you better get your act together.
She rejected the network as a hate-for-profit racket, but fellow Democratic candidate John Delaney said he'd take the airtime if she didn't want it. Now,
is he running?
I don't know who he is.
Who is he? Oh, I don't know. Who is it?
John Delaney. That's no, why he wants to be on. Yeah. So somebody will know. We don't know who you
running.
Are.
Oh,
he's running. Okay.
Well, you got to do a better job getting that message out there. Yeah. None of us knew you were president, bro. And this is our job. So
if we don't know you. You totally, know they don't know you.
Yeah, that's it. If we don't know you, you know that they don't know you. They being everyone else outside The View. Well, folks, that is about as much fun as I'm allowed to have. And Scott will be back next week putting me back in chains as the full-time Joe Biden for President correspondent for this, The Uprising, a production of LibertyNation.com. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Subscribe to the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel. You'll get these podcasts. You'll get our Five Facts videos and our Truth is Making a Comeback TV show and author roundtables and Liberty Nation Radio and a whole lot more on the LibertyNation.com YouTube channel. See you next time.